This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
If you're renting, what's your place like? Do you have solar panels? Do you have mould? I'm Mary Guerin and this is The Conversation Hour, and yes, we've heard a lot about the challenges of renters as part of the bigger picture that's painted by the housing crisis. Today we'll look at two specific challenges that renters are struggling with. Landlords who don't want to or haven't been incentivised to put in solar panels, and also a disturbing amount of mould and other things that don't even meet minimum standards when it comes to rentals. The first one, solar panels, that can lead to big bills, but also being underheated, undercooled in your home. The other, of course, can lead to dangerous health outcomes. I'd love to hear from you. If you are a renter, tell me about what your place is like and what your landlord is doing about it. There are new standards for Victorian landlords that come into effect next March. They don't include solar panels. They're more about heating, cooling, ceiling insulation, draft proofing. Is that fair enough, or should solar panels be part of that in 2027 when it comes into play? If you're a landlord, have you invested in energy updates? And if so, what prompted you? And if not, why not? Would tax incentives work for you? Let me know. Tell me your story. Also, today you might have heard about this horrifying report on ABC News, news that the underground solarium market in Melbourne appears to be booming. We're supposed to have a statewide ban on solariums, sunbeds, whatever you want to call it, solar lamps. Why is that not working? The ban is for commercial use. We still allow private use. Why is that? What's your theory on why this solarium market is booming? What are you seeing and hearing in your life from people around you or you yourself? What are you seeing on your social media feeds that can explain this? After all, we had this message, we still have this message of being sun smart. Surely, drilled into us from childhood. What's happened? What's gone wrong? If you're a sun cancer survivor, maybe after using sunbeds back in the day, how does this news make you feel? Macca from Mount Hotham was reacting to the news. He called in to speak to Bob and Rochelle on breakfast today.
People are so vain. Go out and get a spray tan. I'm a person, seriously, I'm a 65-year-old. 100% Irish, blue-eyed, was a ranger back in the day. I'm a bit grey-haired now, but I've had 525 skin cancers removed. Wow.
525 skin cancers removed. That's Macca. What's your theory? Is it vanity, like Macca says? What's going on in people's heads out there? Why isn't the commercial ban on these beds working? Tell me your theories and your stories, especially if you are a renter and you are asking your landlord for solar panels or maybe just to remove the mould. I'd love to hear from you. If you're a landlord, what incentives are still needed out there? Also today, tell me about your most treasured woolen jumper. I bet you have one. Tell me the story. How old is it? What's it like? Who knitted it? Did you knit it? Did someone knit it for you? We're going to look at that, ask you about your most treasured woolen piece as we dip into the wool auctions that are happening right now in Victoria. But next, what's gone wrong with our messaging or our knowledge about the dangers of sunbeds?
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
So as I said, this report has been exposing a booming market in underground solarium use. And this is despite the statewide ban that we do have in Victoria. Emma Glassenbury is head of SunSmart in the Cancer Council, and she joins me now. Hi, Emma. Thanks for your time.
Good morning, Mary.
What has gone wrong?
Well, I think, as you mentioned before, the proliferation of information on social media certainly hasn't helped. People are promoting and advertising solarium use through social media. So, and as well as that, are also promoting and glamorising tanning. So we see lots of tanning trends on social media promoting tan lines again. So, I think the way in which people receive information and push information is a lot more accessible than it's been before.
Social media is certainly pushing disinformation, a whole range of areas, and this is but one. What struck me this morning is also on breakfast, because many of us assume that it would be vanity, and as you point to, that's one of the options, that one of the motivations that people are using. But one caller to breakfast touted what he perceived as health benefits as well. I guess first off, we'll talk about that in a second, but first off, from your, to be factual, are there any health benefits to a solarium, in case we were in any doubt?
Solariums emit dangerous levels of UV radiation, and it's this UV radiation that causes DNA damage to your skin cells and increases your risk of skin cancer. And because of the loads of evidence behind the dangers of solariums, it led to a commercial ban of solariums across the country over 10 years ago. So there is nothing safe about a tan, and certainly nothing safe about obtaining a tan from a solarium either.
And I'll get to the ban on commercial solariums in a moment. But when it comes to what's being promoted on social media, how much of that has to do with that wider problem of influencers, wellness, going down very strange paths when it comes to social media?
Yes, and we've seen recently the promotion of peptides in the media as well through social media. So I think this is another example of promoting, you know, harmful habit portrayed as glorifying or beautifying tanning. So we really need to work hard to counteract these messages and remind people of the dangers of tanning and solarium use.
Is the Cancer Council or any other authority using social media in order to combat this misinformation on social media?
Yeah, so the federal government has invested in a national campaign aimed at younger Australians 18 to 24 years. So unless you're in that age bracket, you're unlikely to see it. But they've been addressing the dangers of tanning and how this increases skin cancer risk, and been using influencers to try and counteract those negative messages and using influencers to actually promote sun safety to address skin cancer risk.
You're listening to Emma Glassenberry, head of SunSmart. We're talking about the underground use of solariums. Emma, how are they getting in these sunbeds if we have the commercial ban?
So my understanding is people are promoting the sunbeds use at the back of a warehouse or in their home, and taking profits from people actually using their solarium. So that is actually commercial use. And in Victoria, we have the Radiation Act and enforcements in place to counteract this. And if people are concerned, should definitely be calling radiation safety at the Department of Health on this, if they do call out this commercial use of solariums.
But to be clear, Emma, they're getting in these beds in the first place through the allowed private use of solariums?
So private use is actually really low, but yes, you can obtain a solarium through private use. But what the dangers are is this.
Pardon me for interrupting, Emma, but how can we say that it's low if at the same time we're saying that the people who are using it, who are saying they're using it for private use, are also renting it out?
Exactly, and that's what we don't want to see, is this profiting of this use of solariums, because it's just increasing people's personal risk of skin cancer. Anyone stepping into a solarium is increasing their risk of skin cancer, and there's absolutely nothing safe around a tan.
Why are we allowing any private use then, Emma?
Well, private use is difficult, and I can't really comment on that. But what we would like to see is, this enforcement of this commercial use where people are profiting from the commercial use of solariums.
I must admit, I find it really hard to reconcile what we know as fact, that there is no safe UV exposure, and yet we do allow the private use. We've, on Conversation Hour, asked the government for a statement. They've just said the commercial solariums pose a risk, but they didn't answer the question about why they're still allowing private use. Why does the Cancer Council not call for a national ban on private use? What could possibly be the reason?
Well, I think we're taking the core of really educating Australians and the dangers of tanning.
But that's not working.
And also really using the enforcements we have in place to crack down on the promotion and taking profits from the use of solariums.
But again, it doesn't answer the question of why not ban that private use.
It's a complicated conversation, mm-hmm. and there's lots of stakeholders involved. Of course, in an ideal world, no one would be able to access a solarium, but the reality is very different.
And apologies for being obtuse, Emma, but I keep going back to, if this is what we know as the fact, that there is no safe use, then why would we even have that as a loophole that is clearly being exploited?
I think what people are exploiting are people profiting from the use of these solariums. So promoting solarium times, glamorising tanning, there's no one simple solution. It takes a multifactorial approach to address the dangers of tanning, both through solarium and the sun's ultraviolet radiation.
Again, I'll just ask one more time then, why wouldn't we stop people from doing it in the first place, whether it's for themselves or for commercial purposes, to someone else?
Yeah, we should absolutely not be encouraging solarium.
Is it time potentially for the Cancer Council to take a stronger position and for governments to make this move to ban private use?
Yeah, and I think it's also important for us to really highlight the important message here that solarium use and tanning is dangerous to our health. We've made great progress in the banning of commercial solariums, and we're keen to see that progress continue.
Mm. What will you be doing in the light of, I guess, this reporting, which brings to light something that you may have suspected but now brings into a bit more focus?
Yeah, so we need to encourage people to report the dangers of this profiting from the solarium use, but also look at our education and our messages and how we can reach particularly our young people in the dangers of tanning, not just solarium, but also from the sun's ultraviolet radiation as well. So it's that education component as well as the enforcements that we have in place.
Is it time for a rethink of the messages? I mean, this is, I guess, every awareness and education campaign needs a reboot. Is it time for a reboot in 2026 if the message has lost its power?
Look, we certainly have been adjusting our messages, and you can see that through the End the Trend campaign. As if you don't fall into that age bracket, the media buy doesn't reach you, unfortunately, but it's absolutely tapping into those influences that we know influence people's behaviours. So using influences to make sure our messages are meeting the right people in the right way.
Emma, it's a tricky landscape that you deal with, and I really appreciate you coming on and answering the questions today. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mary, for having me.
That's Emma Glastonbury, who's head of SunSmart, which is, of course, one of the longest running skin cancer prevention programs in the world. We are world leaders in this. It's said to be one of the most successful. Just with that backsliding, what is the answer? Lots of texts coming in saying, look, cigarettes are still sold legally. That's not good for us. There's no safe use of alcohol too. So why would I even be bringing this up? What do you think? 1300 222 774 is the number to call. Peter, you're in Geelong. What do you want to say?
Yeah, hi, Ray. Good morning. Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
No worries.
I think it's, you know, crazy. Personally, I've had quite a few skin cancers removed and things like that. So I think it's crazy that people would do this. But, you know, the idea of banning people from having them, you may as well, you know, where do you start and stop with banning things that are bad for people's health? Do you ban cigarettes? You know, do you ban alcohol? You know, do you ban certain types of other activity, which we know is bad for our health, but people do? I think people just have to take personal responsibility.
You know, I hear your argument there, Peter, you know, which goes to free will and in on all of those different medical areas. I guess to play devil's advocate to you, Peter, I'd say that it's easier to get cigarettes, whether they're illegal or not, across a border, or even alcohol. But a sunbed, can't you stop that at the border?
I don't think so.
No.
We know you can't. We know you can't.
Yeah.
They'll come in one way or the other. And it you know, I think this is one of those things where, yeah, you educate people, mm-hmm. but that's all you can do. And you just, I mean, unfortunately, in a large society, you just have to understand that there's going to be a certain number of people who either don't care or are just too stupid to listen.
Is it just not realistic? Peter, thank you for calling. Another Peter from Bendigo. You've called in. I think this is about not solariums, but about renting. Is that right?
Well,
you're a landlord?
Yeah, I was. I sold the house I had. It was a almost new house, and I wasn't prepared to rent it out and be dictated by the government on the terms and conditions that I could rent it out.
In what sense? What were the things that stuck in your craw?
Well, it was a brand new house, 1 year old house with, you know, high level carpets and, you know, fittings and all the rest of it. I'm not going to put somebody in there that's got dogs and cats and all the rest of it, because you can't, one, the damage they cause, but you can't get people out of a rental very easily. So I'm just not prepared. If I've spent, you know, $800K on a property, I would not have a state government tell me what the terms and conditions are that I'm going to rent it.
Would any sticks or carrots work for you, Peter? My guess that I've got this hour is suggesting that maybe even being eligible for negative gearing could be something that is tied to your willingness to put, for instance, solar panels on your property. What would you say to that?
I'd say, again, it's a bit nonsense. I guess, briefly, I'll put it like this. If you need a first car, and you go into a dealership and the dealer, he says, what's your budget? Say, I've got $3,000. And he says, well, here's this, you know, Volkswagen you can have. And you say, no, but I want the new one with the air conditioning, and I want, you know, the special paint, and I want the mag wheels. And the dealer will say, well, that's going to cost you $40,000. And you say, well, I want the $40,000, but I've only got the $3,000 one.
But
Why should the landlord have to pay for that?
To run with this analogy just for a little bit longer, Peter, if you do put those in and then that could justify putting your rent up, would you do that?
Well, how much do you put your rent up? You could be talking, you know, if when you do the sums, and I've done the sums, even the property I sold, I couldn't get enough rent to cover the cost of the house, let alone putting a whole lot of other fancy add-ons on. You know, When I bought my first house a long time ago, it was a three-bedroom, one-bedroom house, and it was 12 squares, and I was damn grateful to be able to buy it. And interest rates went up to 17.5%, yep. And I hung on to it. And now, though, everybody wants to have the four-bedroom, three-bathroom, you know, super deluxe house, but again, they don't want to pay for it.
Peter, thank you for calling in. Yes, I want to hear from landlords as well. We will be talking about solar power not being put in rental properties and what that means for renters. I want to hear from you landlords as to why you may not be doing that, and renters as well. What does that mean for you? Also, a disturbing study of how much mold, which is not cherries on top like Peter was just talking about there, but is actually minimum standards of health. We will be talking about that as the conversation goes on. Also, we started off by talking about sunbeds. Should they be allowed for private use? This on text, just like seatbelts, people have to be protected from their own ignorance. But Gail in Bendigo says, well, Mary, sadly, cigarettes are still sold legally, and it's the same argument. I asked you your story, if you have actually been a survivor of skin cancer. This on text: my best friend died of melanoma 3 years ago. She had a spot on her liver, spot on her lung, and 3 brain tumours. The melanoma was internal, not on the skin surface. We had many years as suntanners in high school. And yes, that's without a sunbed potentially as well for many people. And this on text: for goodness sake, Mary, why is it legal to buy a tanning bed? You can't stop people using them in their homes. Keep up with those calls, 1300 222 774, as we continue through Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. Just to remind you, we did go to the Victorian government and that for a statement about why we still have personal use. They came back with a statement just talking about the dangers of commercial solariums. We will keep on this and see if there isn't some sort of shift in thinking, potentially, or at least when it comes to enforcement of the ban that we already have when it comes to that. 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. We will be talking about rentals. Also, have you got a treasured old woolen jumper? Tell me about it. I'll tell you about mine. Did you knit it? Who knit it for you? We're talking about the great woolen jumpers of our times as we cross to Warwick Long, who can tell us all about the wool auctions.
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
Well, have you got a treasured old woolen jumper? 1300 222 774. My fondest memory of a woolen jumper, and I still have it. It's still in good nick. My nan knitted it for me, I'm going to say 40 years ago, and she used big, chunky, lanolin-smothered wool. She knitted Fair Isle. Was it Fair Isle? Was it Irish cable knit? So chunky I could barely put it over my head, kept me so warm. That lanolin smell hung around for quite a few years. Tell me about your most cherished woolen jumper. We're going to cross to Warwick Long very soon to talk about all things wool. John from St. Albans, tell me about your jumper story.
Hi. Yes, good morning. Good morning, Mary. I've got a beautiful jumper that's been hand-knitted by my wife, and it's multicoloured. It's in lemon, sky blue, white, black, and red. And it's in the style of the Dutch painter, Piet Mondrian.
I had one of those as well, in big squares.
In big squares, indeed, yes.
Was it knitted in the 80s? I think that's when it was big, John.
No. Elaine only knitted this about 6 or 8 months ago.
Oh, Elaine, good on you. And is it warm, John?
It is very, very warm. It's my favourite jumper. I wouldn't go down the street without it these days.
John, thank you. Tell me about your favourite woolen jumper, 1300 222 774. Let's cross to Warwick Long, presenter of the Country Hour. Tell me where you are calling in from, Warwick.
Not far from you, Mary, at all, which is the surprising thing. And I think a lot of Victorians would probably be surprised to know that really only a few kilometres from the CBD is one of really only the very few remaining, the last couple really, of selling centres of wool in Australia. And I'm at the wool auctions today, and they kicked off about 28 minutes ago, and already in the two rooms next to where I'm sitting to today, $4.2 million worth of wool has been sold.
So, oh, my goodness.
It's quite an exciting place to be.
Okay, so how many of these days are there? Is it just one big day of the year? Is it happening?
No. So this is happening a couple of days a week, most of the weeks a year. I think about it must be around 40 or slightly more weeks per year are wool auctions. So basically, when farmers shear sheep, all the wool is put into big bales. That is collected up, goes to a place like this where it's tested for its quality, where some of it is put out on display. And I know you were mentioning the smell of lanolin before. Mm. That is thick in the air when you get to walk all the little displays of the wool clips that are on offer for sale here today in the big shed behind me.
And then,
yes. Yeah, and then you go into these little auction rooms. and they're very modern. They're very, like, just a few rows of seats, people with their laptops out, a man speaking incredibly fast, yelling numbers, and I think you need to train your ear to keep up. And they're just going lot after lot after lot. Few bids come from the room. They're sold nice and quickly, and then we're moving on to the next. And I must say, in the rooms here today, it's been a bit of competition around, and it seems like prices are going pretty well, which is a good sign for an industry that has been having really difficult times lately.
Well, what has been happening with wool prices, Warwick?
So, look, this time about last year, I think wool was around, the Eastern Market Indicator is the indicator that we use for a lot of a sense of the wool industry, because it's classified by the micron from the very fine, which becomes a very expensive suit, to, you know, the very broad, which can end up in things like carpets and so forth as well. So wool is a varied product. But as the industry tries to have this one symbol of how the industry is going, it all comes into this thing called the Eastern Market Indicator. About 12 months ago, that was at around 1,200 and so cents. So we're looking around the $12, $13 a kilo, right? Today, which is part of the reason why the country is here, and part of the reason we're looking at the industry here today, it might break the 2,000 cent barrier. So $20 a kilogram for wool as an indicator of how the industry is going. So not quite doubly as well as last year, but pretty damn close to it. And that is more closely to where the industry needs to be for the price to make farmers make a profit and be able to continue farming than what it was last year. So there is a lot more hope in this room here today than there certainly was at this time last year.
Oh, that is fantastic to hear. This is Warwick Long. He is reporting from the wool auctions just around the corner from me today. Ellen from Shepparton, tell me about your jumper.
Oh, it's a hand-knitted cardigan.
A hand-knitted cardigan? How old is it, Ellen?
Well, I bought it in 1988.
Oh, yes?
I was just diagnosed with type 1 diabetes and I was miserable, and I went into this beautiful boutique in Shepparton. It was called Kath Devine's, and she was gorgeous, and I thought, yes, I deserve this, and I've worn it with love. And I took it out of the suitcase last year to take my two of my grandchildren to the circus.
Oh, fantastic.
The circus babe, yes.
And what? And so it's lasted well? Raph didn't think that they lasted well, but you have to take care of them, don't you, Ellen? What colour is it?
Oh, look, it's hand-knitted. It's all different colours. Just picture a beautiful circus dance. It's got elephants and it's magic. It is magic.
I love it. Thank you, Ellen. Yes, I want to hear all about your favourite, your most treasured woolen jumpers. We all have one. Warwick, I need to ask you. You must have one.
I've got a wool t-shirt on right now, Mary.
There you go. Has it got circus on it?
So there's quite a lot. No, not a circus. It actually says choose merino, like choose life. But, yeah, it's my funky wool shirt. Woolsey is having a moment in terms of finding its way into other wear, and that is a lot to do with the push for more sustainable fibres. So a lot of the clothing we wear comes from petrochemicals, and there's been concerns about that. And wool, cotton, hemp, a whole bunch of other industries have been coming together lately to try and say, look, we grow a lot of these fibres. They might cost a little bit more than the cheap plastics, but they will last an incredibly long time, and we've got new technology going into them, so they're not as scratchy as what you might have thought they were back in the day. But as with everything, there's the cheap of the cheap, which might not be the highest quality, all the way to the really expensive. And you see that in a lot of the industries that we talk about, whether it be wool, cotton, hemp, or any of the other fibres that are available on the market. But it's thought some of that, some of those attitudes, some of, you know, wool jumpers now being in the middle aisle of that supermarket that sells everything in the middle aisles, right?
Mm-hmm.
The hope is that it's finding new homes for these products, and people are suddenly starting to buy them. That's one of the theories behind the price rise in wool at the moment.
Whatever it is, it's good news. Thank you, Woz. Really appreciate you phoning in.
Great to talk to you. I can't believe I'm speaking to you from just outside West Footscray in Tottenham, Mary, but I'll try and be more rural next time.
Great, yes, to talk please. To you. Bit of the country in Melbourne. We need it. Thank you. That is Warwick Long, of course, presenter of the Country Hour. Chris, you're in Essendon. Tell me about your most treasured jumper.
It's not a jumper, but while I was growing up, every year my grandmother would knit a jumper for all of us cousins. There were eight of us at the time.
Ooh,
and then when she got older and stopped knitting, she crocheted a granny throw, and it was made up of all the scrap wool from all of our jumpers, and all us cousins would sit around with this blanket going, that's my jumper, that's my cardigan, that's my vest.
Oh, what a great idea.
My grandmother passed away and my mother has now got that throw.
Oh.
And it's going to end up coming to me one day and then it'll be my daughter's. She was old enough to actually have a jumper made by my grandmother. And then eventually my granddaughter.
The cousins aren't going to fight them for it? They're not going to fight you for it?
No. The cousins won't fight me for it. Or if they tried, I think I'm bigger and stronger. But yeah, that's probably the most valued wool product I know.
Oh, Chris, that is magnificent. Not just the love from your grandma, but bringing in all the family. What a terrific idea. Almost inspires me to get out the knitting needles again. Thank you, Chris. Meredith, you're in Mitcham. Have you got a treasured woolen object?
I do. I have three treasured woolen jumpers. All of them were hand spun by my mother.
And hand then spun?
Yes. My favourite one is the one I inherited from my father when he passed away over 40 years ago. It's the softest feeling wool in a pale grey colour with a few cables down the front.
Oh.
And so it was made with love by my mother for my beloved father. So it's a very, very precious item.
Oh, how wonderful. And it's kept up well?
The moths have enjoyed bits of it and I've had to do some careful
a few repairs
mending
on the way. Oh, yeah, but Meredith... Yeah. How lovely. Thank you for bringing us that story. I'm loving all of these intergenerational woolen jumpers. It does inspire me. Maybe I need to get out those knitting needles, get out some good chunky lanolin smothered wool as well. Jack in Northcote says, I have woolen jumpers knitted by my grandmother in the 70s, all of them primary colours, wore them as a kid, and then my children did too. And this on text, I have an old woolen jumper. When it gets wet, it smells like the sheep that it came from. My kids call it my pizzle wool jumper. Keep those calls and texts coming in. I'm still getting to texts about solariums and sunbeds as well. Lots of different opinions on that, so I'm going to try to get to your text a little later on as well. But this is the Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria, and we want to have a bit of an extended conversation about a couple of challenges when it comes to renters. First, or second, should I say, we're going to be talking about mould and some other things that should meet minimum standards when it comes to rental properties. But coming up next also, we're going to be talking about solar panels. There's a lack of them, relative lack of them, when it comes to rental properties rather than owner-occupied. What can be done about that? Isabella, though, one last word on the jumpers. Have you got a favourite jumper?
Hi, Mary. I do have many favourite woolen jumpers, but I just wanted to tell you a story about when I was younger. It was one summer, there was some bushfires burning around the Latrobe Valley area somewhere. We were in Glengarry and Mum had said, look, kids, we need you to pack your bags, like we might have to evacuate. And so I think maybe I was five or something at the time. I went into my room, packed my bag, and Mum said I came out with a bag full of all my woolen jumpers, warmest clothes, flannelette pajamas, and she just laughed and thought it was the cutest thing. But it wasn't a silly idea. Wool is a good fibre to be wearing in a fire situation.
There you go. Fire smart even at five, Isabella. Do you still have
it? Yeah. No. Oh, maybe. Mum might, but I don't.
Isabella, that is a terrific story. Thank you. I'd love to get to more of your calls about your favourite, your treasured woolen jumpers and whether you still have them. That's coming up. But next, why are so few of the rental properties, relatively speaking, carrying solar panels? What can be done about it? That's next.
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
So what would it take to fix the system that shows that 11% of rental properties have solar panels versus 44% of properties that are owned? That's part of the analysis from the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial analysis, and they are saying that Australian tenants are being left behind in this clean energy transition that we're all working towards. What can be done about it? Jay Gordon is the energy finance analyst at IEFA, who's been looking at that. Thanks for joining us, Jay.
Thanks for having me, Mary.
Well, how did you arrive at the figures that say that renters could save around $20 billion on power bills over the next decade if landlords put on solar panels?
Yeah, so this was a bit of modelling that we did quite recently where we looked at if you're a typical household, and we looked at kind of the total stock of rental properties and the different types of homes that are out there. What would be the impact if you could do a range of different types of upgrades? So things like installing efficient electric appliances, you know, having a better insulated home, but also, as you say, adding solar panels and batteries. And really, all of these things are quite effective at reducing energy bills. In fact, you know, these sorts of home energy upgrades, I would argue, are one of the most impactful things we can do to reduce bills. But solar panels were absolutely a part of that the mix. And like you say, there's something that you know, really is underrepresented in rental properties, despite being a very popular upgrade for owner-occupiers.
If you are a tenant, tell us about your place. Does it have solar panels? Have you asked the landlord? 1300 222 774. If you are a landlord, tell me what you've done and what's standing in your way. Jay, we've already heard this morning from Peter, a landlord, who said, look, I've worked really hard for this, and this seems like bells and whistles that they want on top. They want everything, and it's just not worth my while, essentially, if I can paraphrase him that way. What do you consider to be the situation for landlords, and what would incentivise them properly?
So, look, it is a tricky problem, and it's what we call the split incentive problem. So that's the idea that, of course, it's the tenants who pay the energy bills, so they're the ones who would benefit from solar panels. But, of course, as you say, it's the landlord's responsibility to install them, and they don't have that motivation. And what we've seen is there have been attempts in the past to sort of address this by providing, say, more financial incentives for landlords. Those options are often very ineffective because they don't address that underlying issue that it's the benefits are going to the tenants.
So what would work, do you think?
So we argue that the key lever we need is minimum standards for rental properties that could include a range of upgrades, including solar panels. And the idea really is that, energy, as we know, is an essential service. We all need it to heat our homes, heat our hot water. And over the past couple of decades, more and more Australians have realised that one of the lowest cost ways they can access that energy is by doing these upgrades or installing solar panels. And so we see this emerging gap between rental properties and owner-occupiers, where we don't want renters to be the ones facing the highest costs for accessing those services. So this is about what can we do to address that gap and lift our expectations of, you know, what's the minimum standard for the energy performance of a property to be rented.
I believe you have in the past, and I think this is pre-federal budget, suggested that eligibility for federal tax incentives like negative gearing should be conditional on properties meeting those sort of minimum standards. Has that changed post-budget?
No, look, it's interesting. I think, if anything, it's still very relevant. I guess the thing to point out is with that federal budget, we have seen quite a significant amount of properties that will be considered under grandfathering arrangements. So we know that most existing rental properties can continue to access negative gearing. And obviously there is still a considerable amount of people who can access the capital gains tax discount. So one of the options I think that is right for further reform is still to say, we can, if you're one of those rental providers, you can access those incentives, but only if your property meets the minimum standards.
You're listening to Jay Gordon, who's an energy finance analyst at IEFA, that is the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis. We're talking about solar panels on rental properties, and if you are a tenant, what has your landlord said? Jay, some listeners might be thinking, look, my landlord is hard enough to get hold of, it's hard enough to comply with minimum standards. Those minimum standards in Victoria are actually changing next year, next March, but it won't include the installation of solar panels. Even so, if we're still getting certain standards below the solar panel level put into law. How realistic is it that landlords will voluntarily install solar panels, heat pumps, etc., at a time of cost of living crisis, more crunch when it comes to their expenses as well?
Yeah, it is a really good question, and I think there's, there are examples of people reporting that their landlord is willing and understands the benefits of these things and wants to install them. I think a couple of the things that could really help there is around, better information around the energy performance of the home when it goes up for sale or lease. So at the moment, except for the ACT, there's no requirement to report on the energy features of a home when it goes for sale. And so that means that you might have someone who's made upgrades like rooftop solar, but also like insulation, efficient appliances. And those are things that you could argue should improve the property's value and might be an incentive to do those upgrades. But if those aren't understood or communicated when the property is sold, it might not be something that actually affects the final price.
Is part of your analysis looking at whether or not these rental properties that do have those things are getting better rental results as well?
So that wasn't a particular focus of our analysis. There has been a bit of study looking at regions where there have been minimum standards implemented. So the UK is one place that's had them for a few years now. The ACT has some standards around ceiling insulation. And that seems to indicate that actually there hasn't been necessarily an increase in rents associated with those upgrades, which is obviously a concern that's raised by many people.
Mm. So, Jay Gordon, if the government's adopted your recommendations, what do you think that Australian renting would look like, say, 10 years from now? What's your vision?
So, look, I think the ideal goal here is about lowering that energy gap between renters and owner-occupiers. So ideally, we've got this huge opportunity to take advantage of solar energy and efficient appliances to make our homes more affordable to run. So I think we'd like to see a situation where renters have just as affordable homes as owner-occupiers, and we're not seeing some of the stats that are out there now about renters feeling very hot in their homes in summer or too cold in winter or being unable to afford to heat and cool them. Mm. So really about closing that energy gap.
Jay, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Jay Gordon is Energy Finance Analyst at IEFA. Yes, some of you are saying, look, the cost of panels will be passed on in rent increases. That's what Matt reckons. John, you've called in from McKinnon. What do you think?
Yeah, look, I think you ought to just let everyone know that AGL pay 2 cents a kilowatt hour for the energy supplied, and they charge you, the user, 30 cents a kilowatt hour. But I live in Adelaide as well, and I have to pay 40 cents a kilowatt hour for my electricity usage, and they pay me 2 cents a kilowatt hour for what I produce.
So this is a refund for your solar panel energy on your own house, John?
Yeah. Mm. Well, I rent one, but it's I get $37 credit, and I have to pay a bill of $240.
Right. So you don't think makes sense?
Listen to that.
Yeah. John, thank you. Yes, it's a complex question with many different levers. What do you think would be the thing that would help everyone in this circumstance? Not just the tenants, of course, who are suffering and can't do anything about it potentially and being overheated or too cold, but also the landlords as well. Let's keep that conversation going on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. This also came in on text saying that there is no enforcement of minimum standards of rentals. Well, that's a good segue to my next conversation. There has been analysis that less than 40% of rental housing in Victoria has complied with minimum housing standards. That was measured in 2024, including things like mould, dampness, bathroom and electrical safety among those major issues. That might have something to do with having more compliance audits, that might have something to do with the shocking decline in numbers. But to dig into that, Dr. Anasur Rahman is the lecturer in business, analytics and AI from La Trobe Business School behind this analysis. Thank you so much for joining me, Anasur.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks for your invitation to the program.
So you found overall there was a steep decline in compliance rates over the period in those things that I was talking about, down from about 76% in 2021. 3 years later, it went to what? And why do you think this is?
That's a good question. Okay, so I think when those the minimum standards were introduced in 2021, I believe, as per the the information shared by the Property Compliance Victoria, which is the auditing company. So what I heard from them, so initially when those compliance were introduced by the state government, initially people who think their property is going to comply or pass those standards, so they came forward and they have done the audit. And when, the time progresses, so then more landlord, the more rental providers that came forward, because I think there was a penalty associated as well. Mm. So they came forward and then they have done, the more audit. So around 54% is the compliance pass rate since 2021 to 2024, I think till May. So the audit done, completed by that particular company.
Right.
So they're more reflective, about the participation. So initially, landlord think they're confident their property is going to pass, so they came forward. But towards the end, it was more reflection because more people participated to that, the minimum standard checking,
right.
Because there was a penalty associated with that as well.
Right. So more people are going through these compliance audits. It accounts for some of the figures, but nonetheless, less than 40%, you're saying, of rental housing comply with minimum housing standards when it comes to mould and dampness and so forth. Did that shock you?
No, I think just to correct, for mould and dampness, the overall compliance rate is 73%. Okay.
Right.
But overall, for all 40 individual standards, is 54%.
Right. So mould that's actually okay. Well, what is acceptable? You said 73%, did you?
73%, yeah.
73%. So, what's that? 27% that do not reach those minimum housing standards. Did you analyse what is the problem, some of the structural problems maybe that is happening, which leads to that sort of shortfall?
Yeah, I think so, because I'm not the domain expert in the real estate market, so I'm the data analyst. So the audit was done by the Property Compliance Victoria, so they are the kind of domain experts. So they have done the audit on 11,500 properties. And then they share the data with us and say, hey, can you analyze the data to tell us what's the overall compliance rate as well as pass rate for each individual standards? And then I, they come up with these figures from the data, and the lowest standard, which is mold and dampness, that's 73%. Okay, so yeah, to me, it's really concerning because it could relate to the health issues and why it happened. So this could be the big question. So I think probably you need to go to the experts in that area. So
yeah,
it could be structural soundness related to the bathroom issues, because those standards are also suffering, as I can see from my analysis.
That's the next question. You're listening to Dr. Anasur Rahman, who's from La Trobe Business School, who's looking at the data around whether or not rental properties are complying with minimum housing standards. Anasur, you also talk about that socioeconomically disadvantaged areas are particularly hardest hit.
That is correct. Okay, so just to give you a bit of idea, so when I got 11,500 audit record from Property Compliance Victoria, so they are one of the leading companies, so they check those audits. Okay, so then what I have done, I also link these audit records to the socioeconomic status data that I collected from ABS, Australian Board of Statistics. Now, I also split up the whole Victoria into 9 regions, the bigger regions. Okay, so when we link this data with 2 other data sources, like one of them is like socioeconomic status data. So we have seen, this is really very shocking, that the people or the suburbs with low socioeconomic status has a higher fail rate. Okay.
Right.
Okay. And we have listed that into our report as well as in our research paper that we published in one of the highest quality journal in this area.
Mm.
So that shows, so there's a high correlation with the socioeconomic status. Yeah.
And what's the next step, Anasur, with this data? What do you think that it should be used for when it comes to policy in state or federal government?
I think to me, so I'm, because as I said, like I'm not a, like I'm a data analyst and business analyst guy, so I'm not a, like an expert in policies or the real estate. But what I believe to me, like 100% target for each individual property, I don't know, like is that like too much, or we should have like, if a property is a brand new and if a property is a 30 years old, 20 years old, if we are comparing like brand new property with 30 years old property, I'm not sure, like, should they have the same target, or we should change it, or we should change the target based on the, you know, the geography, considering the geographical factors. So I think those questions could be the policymaker to the state government maybe. So these are the things. But yeah, it's really interesting. But the other thing we found, like when a property fail for a particular standard, what I've seen, like you know, the real estate are quick enough to organizing, you know, the fix for the maintenance. We can see this is also happening quickly. On average, like around 39 days it took for the real estate agent to fix those standards.
39 days. Still so much yet to be done. Anasur, thank you so much for stepping us through those results.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your invitation. I'm happy to share our research outcome here.
Yes, thank you. Dr. Anasur Rahman, who's from La Trobe Business School. This on text from Martin in Eltham. I pay $620 a week for a three-bedroom townhouse in Eltham. No solar panels, some mold in the shower, broken blinds, never fixed, loose fixtures and fittings, possums in the roof, one side fence falling down next to a vacant block. Martin, I hope you're okay there. Thank you so much for texting in. And we've been talking about our favourite woolen items. John in Eltham says, cardigans and matinee jackets knitted by my wife for our daughter in the late 80s, now being worn by our granddaughters and regularly commented on by passers-by when out and about. And my wife's favourite woolen jumper, says this texter, had moth eggs and a moth flew out when she got it out to wear. Apparently one can prevent the moth by putting the woolen jumper into a freezer. But can you put, can you store it in the freezer? There's so much else to put in the freezer. Thank you so much for joining me on The Conversation Hour. You can find it again on the ABC Listen app. Have a wonderful day out there. Take care.